chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass may dab in the middle of it.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a fine program going this weekend. Had a lot of different things going on. We do have an interview that we're going to air, and it's from a pro-Russian fighter on the ground at Donetsk. And bear with us and try to understand that we're trying to introduce a little bit of the alternative news from the Russian side too, just to see and give a little bit of a fair balance. We don't support Russia going into the Ukraine. We think it was a major mistake by Putin and by the Russians. But there are a lot of atrocities occurring within the battles. And some Ukrainian forces are actually promulgating attacks upon some of their own people and then blaming it on the Russians. But first, we're going to start off with an interview with Robert Barnes and Alex Jones. And boy, they hit it. They hit the ball out of the park on this. On what's going on is what has been devised is an international way to lock down this world and to give authority to World Health Organization and other international organizations to put us under their thumb. So here we go with Robert Barnes and Alex.
Isn't that what this is all about? I remember that clip from 4 years ago on C-SPAN with all the big bureaucrats and Fauci, and they said, we're going to have a new virus come out of China, a new bird flu. We'll use that to blow up the old FDA system and other systems worldwide where we can just directly do whatever we want. That's what this whole thing is, a corporate power grab over our bodies.
Absolutely. What they're doing with the FDA is what they want the WHO to have power to do for everybody, ultimately, which is unchecked, unelected, clerical bureaucrats dictating and controlling our entire medical care.
This is so important.
If they own our body, they own our soul.
So, Robert Barnes, you've really been on this. You've been involved filing the big cases for Pfizer whistleblowers in Texas that helped expose all this. So you've really got an inside track on this. We've got about 7 minutes to break. What is your view on what's currently happening? And for me, it's pretty obvious the next big lockdown, the next big rollout, and the way to get this power-grabbing, sovereignty-destroying UN biomedical tyranny in is currently with the smallpox hysteria that I'm predicting is going to go ahead and escalate out of control, just like COVID. What do you think?
No doubt. I was in court on Tuesday in front of a federal judge in Waco with Bobby Kennedy on children's health defense, trying to stop the booster authorization and the vaccine authorization for kindergartners and elementary school-aged children. And the federal judge, to his credit, listened to our argument and said that he would give us permission to amend, to detail and provide more evidence about how this vaccine is harming kindergartners and elementary school children. So if anybody's out in the Waco area, in the Waco region, and they've seen schools be issuing these vaccines or making them freely available without full parental involvement, if they're seeing advertising in the local area, we've seen it from Big Bird, Elmo, everybody else. But if they've seen local advertising that's promoting this vaccine, as we detailed in court, this vaccine is not safe. This vaccine is not effective. This vaccine is not a vaccine, not legally, not medically, not historically, not in the definition of the ordinary public. And the key question is, can the FDA be held liable and held responsible? Because if we could stop this at the source, which is the FDA, then it stops it everywhere else. And so the court laid out that additional facts need to be alleged to satisfy his willingness to let the case go forward, but he was willing to entertain what those facts might be. So if there's anybody in the Waco area that has facts that may be relevant, reach out, let us know. But you're right. I mean, this is what we talked about 2 years ago. We said what this is going to do. You look at Bill Gates' agenda. What they're going to do is they're going to try to require us to take drugs for the rest of our lives, for a disease that is not an imminent risk to most human beings, most Americans, and for a drug that is not a vaccine and that instead is conditioning us like we walk through the airport and we've grown conditioned to have our body inspected as a condition of traveling within the United States domestically. We got to show our papers. We got to let them spy on our stuff. We got to let them look at an effective X-ray of our body just to get on a plane. They're conditioning us in the same way to accept all kinds of drugs right in the arm. And these are drugs we know are dangerous. We know are not effective. I mean, listen to that White House guy for the just lie repeatedly. Oh, well, you know, now the vaccine, well, what does he praise about the vaccine? He says, well, maybe your symptoms might be worse. That's not a vaccine. That's a bad drug. That's a weak drug. That's an ineffective drug. And this is a gene editing drug, as they've admitted and conceded in other places, but failed to do the proper legal requirements to meet it. So now they're going to give it to us at least once a year. I don't know if you're going to be getting in line, Alex, but I think I'll skip that line. This is nothing more than a Bill Gates mandated process for us to be locked in to taking whatever the government tells us to, whenever the white lab coats show up and say, stick this in your kid, stick this in your grandma, stick this in yourself for the rest of your natural born life. And we know from what happened in Kenya, we know from what happened in India, that what happens when you line up for a Bill Gates shot, suddenly weird things start happening. All of a sudden women are sterilized. All of a sudden, people are experiencing diseases they hadn't experienced before. Often they experience diseases that they didn't previously think they could get. And so we're seeing the same thing already with this so-called drug, with this so-called vaccine, with this fake vaccine. And now they want to force us to take it for the rest of our lives.
And, Robert,
and it's a great imminent.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so transparent that Gates says smallpox, monkeypox is coming. And then they roll out a vaccine that's delivered right as it pops up around the world, right as they're trying to ram through this treaty that they admit hands over sovereignty of the nation states, the UN, and gives them military power for sanctions over nations that don't submit. This is world government based on a biomedical dictatorship.
Yeah, it's concentrating power. So right now what they're trying to do is pass internal rules that would only govern the World Health Organization internally. But they are parallel to it, proposing a treaty that ultimately still has to come back to the United States Senate. The United States Senate, two-thirds of them have to pass it. And what they're doing is a bifurcated approach. The first approach isn't the treaty itself, but they're misleading some people into thinking it's the treaty so that people will voice concern now. And then when that treaty doesn't come into place because it's not actually legally a U.S. treaty, U.S. binding treaty, then when they try to sneak it in a year from now, people aren't paying attention. Because they got.
But let's expand on that. They're claiming, though, because Harry Truman in 47 signed on to the WHO, that that's a blanket treaty to follow that, and that Obama's executive order, right before he left office 5.5 years ago, basically put into place similar martial law provisions. And so the bureaucracies, even if they don't officially sign on, are still going to follow the directives.
Constitutionally, it's not. And that's an important point for everyone to know. There's major risk with them trying to do these internal rules. But some people are getting caught up in the idea that acts as a treaty. And you're seeing some misleading legal interpretations out there. No World Health Organization treaty has ever passed. And under the Constitution, nothing is binding law as a treaty unless two-thirds of the Senate approve.
And we've seen good things like federal and state judges saying they can't close churches during these lockdowns, that lockdowns are unconstitutional. So it's taken people a few years to wake up, but there does seem to be a major backlash.
Absolutely. And people need to be alert. Be aware of what this is, but don't get too caught up such that you're not alert when they're actually they plan on proposing an actual binding constitutional treaty. They just plan on doing it about a year from now, where they're hoping people aren't paying. That would be superior law of the land. That would be binding on the U.S. That's what we have to be the most alert for.
All right, Robert Barnes, stay there. Stay there. I want to get into all the other big issues. The Ministry of Truth, it hasn't been canceled, and so much more for 30 minutes with you, then Dr. McCullough and others. All right, in this short segment of the Alex Jones Show, we're going to talk more about the vaccines, the tyranny, and their plans. All these different ministers admit to bring back more lockdowns. When is Robert Barnes thinks it's going to be? And then next segment, we're going to get into the Ministry of Truth, Biden, Ukraine, the whole waterfront of where the world is geopolitically today and what he expects in the midterms coming up in 172 days. But Robert Barnes, for the next 5 minutes, you're at the heart of the resistance of this biomedical tyranny. What are the facts? What else do people need to be made aware of?
No doubt. So on one aspect is the CHD, the Children's Health Defense case against the FDA is marching forward. Anybody that has useful information about what's happening in the Waco area as to young children, as to vaccines, are orphans being forced to take it, or people in foster homes or juvenile facilities being forced to take it against their will. That's relevant, pertinent evidence. If you have any other relevant, pertinent evidence as to children facing imminent risk from taking this vaccine without informed consent, that's one of the target areas of the court's concern that would allow the case to move forward, because our goal is to stop them from lying. The FDA is engaging in a massive deception campaign. The CDC is engaging in a massive deception campaign. They're telling people there's a safe, effective vaccine for an emergency for children related to COVID. This drug is not safe. This drug is not effective. This drug is not a vaccine. This drug does not successfully treat or prevent infection or transmission or disease or disability. And there is no COVID emergency for young children. One of the things that we are challenging in that case is the right to petition the government that's been denied by the fact that they're using their emergency powers to claim they don't have to abide by the Administrative Procedures Act. They don't have. The FDA is claiming they are beyond and above the law. This case goes beyond just children's vaccines in the COVID context. This case goes to the heart and soul of the administrative state. Can a bunch of unelected clerical bureaucrats dictate and determine your entire medical care without even going through the democratized process of citizen petitions, which again is preserved under the First Amendment to the United States Constitution? It's one of the rights people forget about. It's the right to petition your government for redress of grievances. That right is statutorily codified against the FDA as to what's called citizen petitions. It requires that the FDA permit a time period where you can petition them about anything, any agency action or decision that they are making of consequence to the people and the public. It requires that they respond to that, and that they respond to the citizen petition with a meaningful answer. If they're proposing certain rules, they have to go through what's called notice and comment. In other words, they put out the notice to everybody, and they let people with scientific, technical, medical knowledge, and others comment on that, so that that information from the broader public is crowdsourced, and any dissident or dissenting information is made clear, and then they have to answer that. And then when they make a decision, they have to show that they considered every complaint raised, that they considered every fact brought to their attention by the outside community, by the ordinary person. In the context of all these emergency, quote-unquote, emergency use authorized drugs, the FDA has completely failed to do any citizen petition process, any notice and comment process. Not only that, they claim that they can assert emergency powers anytime they want, that it's magic dust, that all they got to do is say emergency, and they can open Pandora's box and do anything they want with anything inside Pandora's box. But not just that. They can also take powers that are not in Pandora's box and just relabel them emergency powers, and suddenly mismarketing a drug is now an emergency power. Mispromoting a drug is suddenly a emergency power. Changing the definition of medical terms like vaccine now is magically an emergency power, such that all of those things were not subject to citizen petitions, notice and comment, or democratic control, or the plain language of Congress when they issued the emergency use authorization statute.
And Robert,
that said, sir,
isn't that what this is all about? I remember that clip from 4 years ago on C-SPAN with all the big bureaucrats and Fauci, and they said, we're going to have a new virus come out of China, a new bird flu. We'll use that to blow up the old FDA system and other systems worldwide where we can just directly do whatever we want. That's what this whole thing is, a corporate power grab over our bodies.
Absolutely. What they're doing with the FDA is what they want the WHO to have power to do for everybody, ultimately, which is unchecked, unelected, clerical bureaucrats dictating and controlling our entire medical care.
This is so important.
If they own our body, they own our soul.
That's right. They own our body, they own our soul. Robert Barnes, constitutional lawyer, back in 60 seconds to shift gears into politics. Stay with us.
Boy, that's hard hitting. This Hariri fellow, he's Israeli, and he's coming up with all these means to try to transform us into some kind of a new transhumanistic system. And he says there's a lot of useless people out there, and what would we do with them? These are some of the comments he made at the World Economic Forum at the last meeting. So here we go with Hariri and what he had to say.
Again, I think that the biggest question in maybe in economics and politics of the coming decades will be what to do with all these useless people. The problem is more boredom. And how, what to do with them, and how will they find some sense of meaning in life when they are basically meaningless, worthless? My best guess at present is a combination of drugs and computer games as a solution for more. It's already happening. In under different titles, different headings, you see more and more people spending more and more time or solving their inner problems with drugs and computer games, both legal drugs and illegal drugs. If you look at Japan today, and Japan is maybe 20 years ahead of the world in everything, and you see all these new social phenomenon of people having relationships with virtual spouses, and you have people who never leave the house and just live through computers. I think once you're superfluous, you don't have power. Again, we are used to the age of the masses of the 19th and 20th century, where you saw all these successful, massive uprisings, revolutions, revolts. So we are used to thinking about the masses as powerful. But this is basically a 19th century and 20th century phenomenon. I don't think that the masses, even if they somehow organize themselves, stand much of a chance. We are not in Russia of 1917 or in 19th century Europe. What we are talking about now is like a second industrial revolution, but the product this time will not be textiles or machines or vehicles or even weapons. The product this time will be humans themselves. We are basically learning to produce bodies and minds. Bodies and minds are going to be, I think, the two main products of the next wave of all these changes. That is optional. Again, and if you think about it from the viewpoint of the poor, it looks terrible because throughout history, death was the great equalizer. The big consolation of the poor throughout history was that, okay, these rich people, they have it good, but they're going to die just like me. But think about a world, say, in 50 years, 100 years, where the poor people continue to die, but the rich people, in addition to all the other things they get, they also get exemption from death. Once you really solve a problem like direct brain-computer interface, when brains and computers can interact directly, for example, to take just one example, that's it. That's the end of history. That's the end of biology as we know it. Nobody has a clue what will happen once you solve this. If life can basically break out of the organic realm into the vastness of the inorganic realm, and you cannot even begin to imagine what the consequences will be, because our imagination at present is organic. So it's if there is a point of singularity, as it's often referred to, by definition, we have no way of even starting to imagine what's happening beyond that. Looking before the point of singularity, just as the trend is gathering pace, the new attitude, I think, is to treat old age and death as technical problems, no different in essence than any other disease. It's like cancer, it's like Alzheimer's, it's like tuberculosis. Maybe we still don't know all the mechanisms and all the remedies, but in principle, people always die for one reason and one reason only, and then these are technical reasons, not metaphysical reasons. People today actually manage to live, many people, as isolated, alienated individuals. In the most advanced societies, many people live as alienated individuals with no community to speak about, with a very small family. It's no longer the big extended family. It's now a very small family, maybe just a spouse, maybe one or two children, and even they might live in a different city, in a different country, and you see them maybe once in every few months, and that's it. After millions of years of evolution, suddenly, within 200 years, the family and the intimate community break, they collapse. Most of the roles fulfilled by the family and by the intimate community for thousands and tens of thousands of years are transferred very quickly to new networks provided by the state and the market. You don't need children. You can have a pension fund. You don't need somebody to take care of you. You don't need neighbors and sisters or brothers to take care of you when you're sick. The state takes care of you. The state provides you with police, with education, with health, with everything. In terms of ideas, in terms of religions, the most interesting place today in the world, in religious terms, is Silicon Valley. It's not the Middle East. This is where the new religions are being created now by people like Ray Kurzweil, and these are the religions that will take over the world.
They're just trying to figure out what to do with us useless human beings, I guess, when we won't take the mark of the beast and we're uncooperative and we're rioting in the streets. We won't take shots or vaccines or anything else. So, you know, what I recently went to last Thursday night, I went and saw 2,000 Mules. And I just want to tell you that that is worth going to. And I'm going to put up a separate clip, a little video clip of myself and my views, in my opinion, my review of that 2,000 Mules. But I'll say right now, you've got to go see that. It is overwhelmingly convincing, and it's just really difficult to go against it. I mean, you just can't refute it. It's just too overwhelming. Next, we're coming up next is the CBS report on the first head of the Department of Homeland Security Disinformation Council that has resigned. And she says that it's because of disinformation on the web that was created by the right or whoever, the, you know, disgruntled people that complain that really destroyed their ability to do this. But the Homeland Security, be careful. They're going to employ this in many other ways. So we can't just let this drop right now. But this was a very good interview about why she quit. Here we go next.
Nina Jankowicz, the head of the Disinformation Governance Board at the Department of Homeland Security, has resigned. This comes after Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas paused the program just 3 weeks after it was announced amid criticism from Republicans. The board was established in April to standardize the handling of disinformation across various agencies in DHS. Nina Jankowicz joins us now. Thank you so much. She's the former executive director of the Disinformation Governance Board. She also is the author of How to Lose the Information War and How to Be a Woman Online. So, Nina, do you think the Disinformation Board was the victim of, in fact, misinformation, given the backlash it saw?
Actually, Jamie, I would say that the Disinformation Governance Board was the victim of disinformation. So the difference between dis and misinformation is disinformation is false information spread with malign intent. And clearly there was a malign intent on some actors in the media and in politics who just really stood up to the formation of this board because it would be confronting disinformation. They completely mischaracterized its mission. And frankly, this childish behavior is endangering our national security now. This board was set up to counter real disinformation that makes Americans less safe. Things about false information related to disasters, border security, our elections and other critical infrastructure like pipelines and banks. So those who stand in opposition to the board, which, as the secretary said, was just an internal coordinating mechanism, something to make sure that we were efficient and using best practices, are standing in the way of our national security.
It is. This is a tough one here. And I have to tell you, the things that I was reading about what was said to you online and how your family had to deal with death threats in particular, you're an expert on disinformation online and in particular women who experience online abuse and harassment. Can you describe for people just what your life has been like and, you know, just what your family was under?
Well, Jamie, I've dealt with harassment before, but nothing like this. This was 3 weeks of just an onslaught. There were maybe 1 or 2 days over the past 3 weeks where I didn't have to report a violent threat to the security services at DHS. And your viewers can't see, but I'm 38 weeks pregnant. Not that saves me from criticism, but certainly I believe that we should be able to have a serious conversation in the United States about real issues that, you know, I understand why Americans are upset about the idea of a board that might decide what's true or false. Of course, that's not what the board was going to be doing, but I don't deserve death threats for my public service to the country. And so I hope that we can walk this discourse back and recognize that this vitriol, this partisanship, makes us more vulnerable to the threats, the very threats that the Disinformation Governance Board was set up to address.
Well, it doesn't matter where you fall in the political spectrum, right? And we've become so far apart. And I understand that people, you know, want to argue with each other and they want to see the world in black and white. But to get death threats is just, it's just unacceptable. I mean, I just find it completely unacceptable. So I'm sorry you had to go through that. I don't think anybody on either side of the aisle should have to go through that. And I have to imagine that it is one of the reasons you stepped down from the board. Can you explain maybe some of the other motivations of stepping down?
So I'm happy to take one for the country when it comes to protecting our national security and putting these issues at the forefront, because I do believe they are some of the most pressing issues of our time. It was less about the threats and more about the department's response to this disinformation campaign and the threats against me that caused me to step down. The board is now, its future is now uncertain. And again, I believe these are really, really important threats that deserve to be looked at very seriously. And I believe I can do that outside of government. I'm not going to be silenced by my critics. And I hope that the department will go forward with this important work because it is critical. As I said, it has to do with the safety and security of all Americans. Things like making sure that people have access to disaster aid, making sure that they have good information about when and how to cast their vote in democratic elections. This is the stuff that the Department of Homeland Security is charged with doing, not any of the falsehoods people were characterizing the board as dealing with online. So I hope that work continues. I know I will be continuing it regardless of the threats, and I hope the administration responds to these attacks with conviction in the future.
You know, I have to ask you, a number of people in the Republican Party came after you for some tweets from the past saying that they were too political. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I have to say that there are 250,000 employees at the Department of Homeland Security. I was one of them. We all have different political inclinations, and we all checked them at the door. As a political appointee, I was also subject to the Hatch Act, which limits my political activity, and that's something I took extremely seriously. You know, as a private citizen, I expressed my opinions with my First Amendment rights, and fighting for those First Amendment rights, making sure that the Department of Homeland Security was doing its work in addressing disinformation with respect to the First Amendment, with privacy rights, civil rights, and civil liberties is one of the reasons that I went there. I went there to protect those rights and serve the country, all Americans, regardless of political inclination. And since I wasn't adjudicating on what was true or false, but just trying to equip people with information they could use in issues of national security, you know, I don't think that my political convictions really come into play here. And as I said, I checked them at the door. I was fighting for those First Amendment rights. And I think it's quite ironic that Republicans would decontextualize a couple of tweets in a career that has been marked by reasonableness, nuance, and bipartisanship. I have been an advocate for policies coming from Republicans like Senator Rob Portman, who put together a great deepfakes bill last summer in the National Defense Authorization Act. And I've been a Republican and Democratic witness in Congress. So I would point to those parts of my CV and my resume and not these tweets and parts of my personal life that have been picked on in this childish game in order to endanger our national security. That's what's going on here.
Well, you did reveal that part of your personal life is that you're going to have a child, so congratulations on that. We'll focus
thank
on
you.
Moving forward. Nina Jankowicz, thank you so much. Appreciate you being with us.
This next report are these Disney toys. Sex toys and stuff that they're going to be promoting. Disney, when I was growing up, was making some very fine entertainment for young people and for children. They've gone way, way off the track now. But this is a report now coming out of Newsmax of the types of articles and products that they're pushing on our young people. And this is something that we've got to resist. But here's the report about what Disney is doing now.
We're inching closer to June, which also is Pride Month, and Disney is launching a new LGBTQ Pride collection aimed at children in preparation. Now, this collection ranges from things like T-shirts and rainbow backpacks, pins, even there's tumblers with reusable straws. And the collection will extend to your pets, having collars and leashes for sale there. And a statement on the website does read this. The Disney Pride collection was created by LGBTQIA plus employees and allies at the Walt Disney Company. And basically goes on to say it's a reflection of their incredible contributions, that they stand in solidarity with the LGBTQIA plus community everywhere. And profits from the Disney Pride collection through June the 30th will also be donated to organizations that support LGBT youth and families. John.
All right, thanks, Bianca. Let's welcome in our panel to discuss this. Republican strategist Aaron Perrine's with us. Patrice Lee Onwuka, the director of the Center for Economic Opportunity at the Independent Women's Forum, is back with us as well, and so is retired NFL player and entrepreneur Jack Brewer. Patrice, want to start with you on this one. Is Disney selling out its like core group? I mean, kids like from the heartland of America, you know, to appeal to a whole new demographic here? This seems like quite a shift in their business model.
Well, John, good to see you and everybody today. I think they're digging deeper into this ideology and trying, you know, to really think that they can push these ideas down to young people. I was just looking at this backpack thinking, I remember when the rainbow represented the promise that God made to us that he wouldn't destroy the earth by water again. Now it's been co-opted for a totally different reason. And Disney will see the backlash. And I think it's interesting when we see other companies that are now pulling back on this gender ideology and this idea of trying to make these children more woke when it comes to gender questioning. They're going to feel a backlash. And it wouldn't surprise me if this is the last time we see these backpacks used for this purpose.
Aaron, are you okay with Disney appealing to kids with this stuff?
You know, I can see this a little bit of both ways, only because there are probably children whose parents are Disney fans. They're Disney fans as well, and their parents might be gay. So for that portion, absolutely. But this does speak to the larger issue that we are seeing with corporations, and certainly with Disney, especially on the Don't Say Gay bill, where they are pushing indoctrination and falsehoods about what should be taught to children, what is taught to children, and what we should be speaking to children about. Children at these young ages shouldn't be having conversations about sexualization, about sexual identity. I don't understand why corporations and the Democrats seem so hell-bent on teaching children about sex when they are younger and younger and younger, instead of teaching them things like writing and math and skills that they will need to go on into middle school and high school. We shouldn't get distracted by this. They will continue to try to do this, but we need to stay laser focused on making sure we protect children going into the future and prevent indoctrination.
You know, Jack, when you have some of the kids you work with at an event with Governor Ron DeSantis, you get slammed. You get accused of using the kids as props or a ploy in, you know, you're really just trying to support kids and dads and families. But there's no backlash, really, from most of the establishment press on this, or not even any curiosity about what they're actually doing.
Yeah, that's such a great point, John. I mean, to see these two worlds collide and you can literally get slammed like myself just for standing up for not wanting kids to be considered oppressed and oppressors and wanting quality education for every kid and kids that get D's and F's to be uplifted by the educational system. I'm blasted for that. But now you can indoctrinate the kids. You're talking about the largest organization, media organization in the world that targets children, is now pushing LGBTQ and anti-Christ agenda. It really is a sad thing when you start to see it. And what you think about ESPN, too, I mean, Disney owns 80% of ESPN. And so their power and their ability to go into mainstream media goes beyond, I think, what many people realize. And I think this is just the beginning. This is a spiritual battle that we're going to face. I'm totally against it, as you already know. But for me, it's disheartening. It's a sad day.
But, you know, to echo what Patrice was talking about, we do start to see some companies moving the other way, Netflix being one of them. A Variety reporting that Netflix has pulled the plug on several animated projects, including one called Wings on Fire. It was based on the book Anti-Racist Baby, written by Ibram X. Kendi, you know, How to Be an Anti-Racist, the author of that book. And also another one called Kind Regards from Kindergarten, which is a story of a darker children's book about two young friends who drift as one of them loses his imagination. Sources at Netflix told Variety that decisions not to move forward with these projects were creative rather than cost-related, whatever that means, Patrice.
Well, I would have to think that they have data. They have data on how some of these programs are already performing on their streaming service. And I suspect that other types of content actually would do much better. That traditional kids programming that doesn't, you know, inject these ideologies into these young minds probably do a lot better. Things like Bubble Guppies and Paw Patrol that teach us how to appreciate police and law enforcement probably do a lot better than this type of content would ever do. And so they're probably recognizing that and making a decision to say, you know, we will choose the Dave Chappelle's, we will choose the Paw Patrol's over some of this other ridiculous content. And it's a good step, and I hope they don't backtrack.
Do you believe, Aaron, that this is a, you know, creative decision rather than a cost decision? Because I think what Patrice is talking about is probably true. They see the data on this, and it's probably more a business decision than anything else.
Oh, I completely agree that this is much more likely a business decision with their content and their dollars. We know Netflix is kind of tanking right now. They're losing subscribers. They're losing market share. And so they're trying to find ways to revamp and bring more people on board. And the attempt to indoctrinate children with things about being an anti-racist baby is certainly not going to bring more masses to Netflix. This is purely a business decision by them. And I would actually be very hard-pressed to find a racist baby. It just shows how out of touch they really are with what families are looking for content-wise, which is why you see their business doing so poorly.
Right. Racism, hatred is a learned thing, and so often, especially, I mean, if you read How to Be an Anti-Racist, it's baked into that book, even though the title would say otherwise. Jack, one more thing we want to talk about here is Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors is blaming some of her issues right now with money on something she calls white guilt money. She talked to MSNBC in a podcast over there called Into America's Podcast, and it was a major shock when BLM raised that $90 million after George Floyd's death, and that was a lot of white guilt money, she said. There's a lot of white folks being like, we just got to put the money out there. This woman is so obsessed with race and dividing us about our race. It's kind of amazing to me that it took this long to expose her.
You're right. I mean, at what point? And you remember, even the families of some of these folks that have lost their lives, that this woman has gone out and raised money off of their slaying. She has not given them anything. They have called for it. They've been screaming loud. And it just shows you what the liberal media is made of. Whenever you have the very victims in which are being used as props and their stories being promoted to raise funds, and this lady doesn't even do anything for them. And you see it every day. It's no different than what's going on right now. This past weekend, you had almost 100 people shot in the streets, inner cities across America, but you hear nothing from these folks. It's the same thing. They raise money off of going in and trying to push and promote an oppressor versus the oppressed mentality. And it's something that they figured out. They're paying their family members hundreds of thousands of dollars from these monies that they're raising. Something must be done. I mean, at some point, when is there a real investigation that's going to come in to stop this from happening in the future? It's just we have too many underserved kids in the particularly the black community that are getting locked up every day. Fatherless kids that can't read and write at their proficiency levels, and nothing's being done for that. But organizations like this aren't held accountable. At some point, our government needs to do their job and get back to enforcing law and order and holding folks accountable in this nation who are using the most vulnerable to enrich themselves.
Yeah, where's the evidence that Black Lives Matter has benefited any of these black communities at all? And obviously, many times it's to the contrary of that. Great to see our panel.
Coming up next is a report from Russell Bentley. Now, he's over in Donetsk area, and he's going to report some false flag operations run by the Ukrainian government against its own people, and then blaming that on the Russians. and these Italian magazines and stuff are picking up with photographs that they got there and blaming the Russians on some of these attacks that were promulgated as false flag attacks by some secret units within the Ukrainian military. So here we go with Russell Bentley, what he had to say.
We get a chance to spend an hour with Russell Bentley, who has been a friend of this program and a friend of the Ukraine people. He is, in fact, a Ukrainian right now, a Russian-Ukrainian, as it were, and probably just a Russian to wrap it all up. Russell, where are you and how are you?
Hi, Jeff. Great to be on your show again. Thank you very much for having me. Right
My
now,
pleasure.
I'm in the center of the city of Donetsk, which is the capital of the Donetsk People's Republic, one of two republics that broke away from Ukraine after the U.S.-backed coup d'etat in 2014.
Donetsk is a beautiful city, thanks to you and the videos you've made available for years now. Americans have gotten to take a look at something they would otherwise only read lies about. Lies spewing out of Kiev, lies spewing out of that little creep's mouth. I cannot stomach the guy. And I won't stop there. The lies continue, coming from NATO, Western European countries, the UK especially, and the American mainstream media. I have never, as I said, seen more falsehoods being presented as news. Never. Just as sickening.
And, you know, I'll give you a couple of examples, Jeff, of just how really bad it is. I recently wrote an article for a website called Covert Action Magazine, and I put some photos in there. On the 14th of March of this year, the Ukrainian army launched a premeditated mass murder terrorist attack on the center of Donetsk with a Tochka-U ballistic missile.
Yep.
This is a very, very old Soviet-style missile, but it's still very deadly. It contains a 1,000-pound warhead. The warhead can be high explosive, it can be nuclear, it can be chemical, or in this case, it was anti-personnel. It was filled with cluster bombs. And what they had done in the preceding days is they had used their troll army on Russian social media, and they had put out a bunch of false news items saying that the wives and mothers and sisters and daughters of people that were serving in the Donetsk People's Republic Defense Forces could go to the Republic Administration Building on Monday at 12:30, and there they could get information on the status of their loved ones that were serving in the army.
Yeah.
And this was the target. This was fake news. And in fact, the Ukrainian SBU, which is like the Ukrainian CIA, Secret Service Gestapo, had even spoofed DPR, Ministry of Information phone numbers, and had sent text messages out to people, the wives and daughters of soldiers that said the same thing, to go to the administration building at 12:30 on Monday, March 14th. And I know this for a fact because I actually I had a friend that was wounded, and I went to visit him in his hospital, and his daughter was there, and she showed me the text message on her phone, you know, so it's not a rumor or anything. I can confirm it with my own eyes. And so they fired this Tochka-U with the anti-personnel cluster bombs, which are illegal, by the way.
Yes.
They're prohibited weapons.
Right.
And our air defense hit the missile and deflected it from the administration building. And fortunately, of the 50 cassettes of cluster musicians, of munitions, only two of them went off. And but still, just to show how deadly this weapon is, since only two out of 50 went off, but it still killed 24 people, 24 innocent civilians that were just driving down University Boulevard on a nice spring day. Mm-hmm. Now, that's pretty bad. I mean, and I was there, you know, a couple hours later, you know, blood all over the street.
We got your story. We got your pictures. I saw it. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so, but here's the thing. The very next day, an Italian newspaper called La Stampa, on their front page, there was a photographer who took a picture of, you know, maybe four or five dead bodies in the street, you know, the emergency services there working, and this one man who was standing weeping over the body of his wife who had been killed.
And I saw it.
La Stampa stole this picture from this photographer who had published it on his website or whatever.
Yeah.
They stole it. They didn't ask permission. They didn't pay him. They didn't even credit him. And they put it on their front page. And then the headline, you know, Ukraine braces for more Russian attacks. So literally, they show a picture of Ukraine murdering our civilians, and then they imply by their headlines that it's Russia murdering Ukrainian civilians. That's not a lie. That's a damn lie. That is the exact opposite of the truth.
We really have to, Russ, excuse me, but honestly, this is top drawer bullshit that they're throwing out. They're corrupting reality. They're inventing reality. This is beyond lying. They've got the best of the best disinformation liars working for the Kiev dictatorship. They've outlawed all opposition parties, for God's sakes. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, dude, my at the beginning of this operation, I'd had a YouTube channel for more than a dozen years. And I had done a lot of work on that, especially since I'd been here. But I also had, you know, like music videos that I'd put up years ago and stuff like that. And right at the beginning of Operation Z, which is not an invasion, it is a liberation, a denazification of foreign-backed Nazi government.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning of Operation Z, I made a 40-second video just, you know, showing me with, you know, a bunch of Russian tanks and saying that these guys are getting ready to liberate Ukraine. We're going to help the good guys, and we're going to kick the ass of the bad guys. And in one day, it got 150,000 views, and it got me 15,000 new subscribers, which was great, except then the next day, YouTube deletes my channel. I mean, I've been deleted from Twitter since 2016. I got deleted from Facebook maybe in 2020, and now from YouTube. The only real platform, I had two websites, both of which got hacked, and I'm now locked out of. And I started the third one on Wix. And then I get this message that, you're not allowed to have a website on Wix. We've deleted it.
Wow.
So, I mean, the only platforms that I have for media right now for, you know, journalism, I mean, and I do write and publish in, you know, various, you know, alternative news websites and stuff like that. I'm very grateful to be able to be on your show, because I know it reaches a lot of people, and that's important. But the only thing that I have, like, for daily, you know, news and communication is VKontakt, also known as VK. It's like Russian Facebook, but without the censorship, and actually with a much, much higher quality of information, discourse, and people. It's worth the trouble of trying to get on there. You know, it's in Russian, but there's, you know, browsers. I use the Firefox browser and an add-on called Translate Websites. And in two clicks, the whole news feed, all the comments, all the links and everything is translated into English. I mean, it's just a much better way of getting news. And it doesn't have the, you know, the absurd censorship that Facebook or Twitter has.
Coming up next is Jay Dyer speaking on the Game of Nations A Morality of Power Politics by Miles Copeland. And it features the focus of the book was on Egypt, and there was a small part on Syria, and it has to do with the regime changing, and also it has to do with Nasser. And Miles Copeland is saying that they took over Egypt and started controlling Nasser. So anyway, this is what Jay Dyer is going to finish our program with for this evening. And when you hear the music, you'll know it's at the end of the program. But we're going to close out as much of that with this fine report by Jay Dyer.
Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host for this fourth hour, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis, and also of the YouTube channel, Jay Dyer, and also of the Rockfin channel, Jay Dyer. Great free speech-based platform. And, of course, also here at band.video or battleplan.news. You can also find all kinds of excellent cutting-edge information here, so be sure to keep putting out those links and that information. You know, in my fourth hour, typically what we do is we get into really hardcore lectures about the deep plans of the elite. We always go through books. We always go through the real writings of the elite, and that's so key to do because there's still skeptics out there. There's still people that can be awakened through understanding that all of this information is already out there in the public domain. You just have to know where to go and where to look. One of the ways that we know this is not just from the globalist white papers and that kind of thing, which is very important, but a lot of people don't know about the spy biographies that are out there. A lot of spies later on in their life, as they were getting into the latter years, the twilight years, they would write down all of their escapades. And while it's true that we can't take everything that they said at face value, even if half of what they write or 75% of what they write is the case, we can get a real key insight into the operations of these busybodies and busy bees of the elite. One of the best spy biographies that I've read is the very rare, hard to find. It took me many years to get a hold of a copy of this, and that is the book Game of Nations by Miles Copeland. This is the Copeland that you may recognize from The Police. Now, it's that family. Now, Stuart Copeland is from The Police, but he's a relative of Miles Copeland, the famous CIA operative. And this Game of Nations book is a fascinating insight into his escapades during the Cold War in both Syria and Egypt. Now, he did most of his operations in Egypt. He didn't spend all of his time in Syria. He did a few things in Syria, and then he went on to work in Egypt with Nasser. Now, I'm not going to be going into a lot of the history of the Cold War and all that. Mainly what we want to focus on in this amazing book, this amazing tell-all, is the overall globalist elite plan that is totally admitted in the book. We want to look at the strategies of revolution, how to engineer, how to steer revolutionary movements, how to control chaos, managed chaos, arc of crisis type model, and how ultimately this ties into long-term plans that the corporate global elite had, in this case for Egypt, but in the long term, it's a model for the whole world. So remember, this is going to be a microcosm of the CIA operations that were done, according to Miles Copeland, in Egypt with Nasser. And then how we can see that as a zoom out, that's exactly what they do now. It's exactly the siege chaos model that the same power entity, the same group, is enacting in our country. The U.S. is undergoing the exact same models and strategies of attempting to collapse and a controlled collapse of the country, not just for chaos, but to bring in the new order, to bring in the phoenix from the ashes. Order out of chaos. Now, Miles Copeland begins his book by saying that we call this the peace game, this game of nations. Remember Brzezinski's grand chessboard model, his book of how we have the players, the people, the presidents. There are pieces on the chessboard that we move around. And he says, you may have heard of this famous, believed to be a conspiracy text called The Report from Iron Mountain. Yeah, actually. Miles Copeland starts his book out by talking about the report from Iron Mountain. And why would he do that? Well, he says everybody kind of thinks about this. It was printed as a kind of a satire. But he says, did you know that this was actually based on a real thing? He says it was based on the CIA Games Center, a.k.a. Game Theory, Game of Nations. And he says that I'm going to explain in this book how I played the Game of Nations, how I was engaged in this consultation level at a high level with as a liaison between the CIA under the cover of a private consulting firm, telling and advising Nasser what to do. He says even controlling the periods, managing the periods when Nasser appeared to be anti-U.S., he'll say. Now, the first thing he says is that let me tell you the rules of the Game of Nations. The number one rule is that it's not about morals. There's no morals in this game at all. It is purely about winners. Winning, hashtag winning. Remember Charlie Sheen? It's pure tiger blood. Winners and losers, that's it. He says, we assume that a nation state, for example, will operate in terms of maximizing power and minimizing personal loss. He says that's the way that we'll manipulate the leaders of the other countries. In this case, it'll be Nasser. He says that we assume moral relativism. So remember that in the game of geopolitical public, you know, international sphere, it's not about right and wrong. It's not about morals. Morals only come in when you want to call somebody out and make them look bad, right? Virtue signaling. And a key section next is that he says, we were actually experimenting at this time. Get this. This is pretty wild. And he wrote this book in 1969. Okay, so Copeland wrote this in 1969. He says, we began experimenting with computer-generated models of decision information and game theory devised by the RAND Corporation. So in other words, Egypt, he says, was a test bed for the RAND Corporation running game theory, Herman Kahn, rational choice theory models on Egypt. And he says that we would put all this information into this old-ass computer, this old computer, right? Like a something out of an old movie. And he said it would spit out what would be our best objectives in these situations. Now, that's amazing because I don't think most people think about using computer information back that long ago in the 1960s. But he says that that's what the CIA Game Center was involved in. He says, next of all, you have to understand that we're purely pragmatic in this process. We're not guided by any ideology other than winning. And that's why he says, in the Game of Nations, we must reduce our approach to pure pragmatism, will to power, and lying. He says that this is the strategy and technique of regime change. He says that regime change and control of nations is a zero-sum game. He says that in the original process of this with Nasser, he says we had to give him, pay him off $50 to $60 million. He says ultimately it was about partly the control of the Suez Canal. Copeland claims to have been a key figure in that. And then he says that ultimately we have a long-term game. And he says that most of the people involved in the Cold War espionage machinations and whatnot, they don't even know the long-term goals of the rules of the game and the Atlanticist American power block, what they wanted to achieve. You're going to be blown away when I get to who he says to go read to understand the long-term game plan. But he does say, quote, that ultimately this is about bringing in a global brotherhood of man, a new order of the ages, and a new order of the world. And he says, if you want to understand how we got to that, he says, realize that out of the two world wars, the U.S. got transformed into USA World Police. Everybody knows about Team America, remember that old satire? That's actually out of CIA writings and CIA manuals. Miles Colton himself said that the U.S. was engineered into a world police model where they would be the enforcers of the inner deep state core who wanted to use America as the engine of the NWO. And he even specifically says that the United States took over the old Pax Britannia